Hello and welcome to the China Business Brief, a podcast by the China Britain Business Council, where we explain the latest news relevant to anyone working in or with the world's second largest economy. I'm Joe Cash, and joining me again this week is the CBBC's UK-based policy analyst, Torsten Weller, for an episode where we're going to focus on a new major political issue that has been set out by the party, but has resulted in a lot of head-scratching amongst those working for foreign and Chinese businesses alike, common prosperity. Torsten, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello, Joe, and I'm very excited to be back.
You better be. It's season two. You're the first guest. Let's get underway with common prosperity. And the place to start is fact-checking what I just said right now, because, well, it's not anything new, is it? While few across China have been considering it before August this year, it's actually an idea that's been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the term common prosperity is actually a Maoist term. And since then, it has undergone quite some transformation. However, the usage of the same term by Xi Jinping has caused some confusion, not just among foreign analysts, but even like among Chinese citizens and bloggers who all thought, okay, well, common prosperity means we're going back to the heydays of Maoism and kind of social egalitarianism. But that is, of course, not what it means. And Chinese officials, including the Chinese ambassador to the UK, have pointed out that it doesn't mean egalitarianism and it doesn't mean a return to Maoist orthodoxy. So what does it mean? So if we look at the actual concrete policy proposals, and especially the policy proposals in Zhejiang province, which has set up its first common prosperity pilot zone and its five-year plan for achieving common prosperity until 2025, then the actual targets are quite underwhelming and don't really point towards some kind of radical shift towards socialism or Marxism or however you want to call it. Maybe to better understand the actual direction of this policy campaign, if you want to call it like this, is to look at the three types of contributions that Chinese policymakers talk about. So you have the first contribution, which is kind of a share of capital and gains and profits between business owners and workers. So this is what Chinese policymakers call a primary contribution. The secondary contribution is about transfer payments, health insurance, unemployment insurance, like pensions, these kind of transfer payments, which are usually associated with a welfare system. And the third contribution is the tertiary contribution is through charity and taxation of high net worth individuals like movie stars. So the third type is actually the theme that kind of started this whole debate, because we had recent high profile cases of movie stars that got caught for tax avoidance, like Fang Bingbing was kind of detained for several weeks. So that was the actual trigger of the current debate, like in most of the Chinese and Western media. But that is actually just about tax compliance, right? This is not about a welfare system. And if we look at these three types of contribution more broadly, then what the Chinese government is really focusing on right now is actually the first one, and it's the last one. So the second one, which really would fit into the kind of category of establishing a true welfare state in kind of Western sense, that is something we haven't seen yet much. And so far, what common prosperity means is more common to what we would associate in the West with some kind of center-right approach to welfare state. So they still want to focus on job creation. They still want to focus on business promotion. And on top of that, they want to improve tax compliance.
So if it's been around since the 1950s and it's not a return to socialist orthodoxy, why is it steadily being ramped up by President Xi now? There was a good piece in Bloomberg over the summer when Common Prosperity first attracted everyone's attention by Lucio Liu, mapping the term's usage over the last couple of decades. What's the reasoning behind its unveiling this summer? Why now?
I think there are several reasons, but I think one of the most important ones is that we had a major shift last year, which I think a lot of people haven't yet fully internalized. And that is kind of the end of GDP as a key performance indicator for Chinese politicians. So this year, that is the first year where we don't have a fixed GDP target. We have a low target, like 6% for this year, but we don't have a GDP target for the next 5 years. So, and that has completely changed the way Chinese politicians and Chinese policymakers approach certain problems. Before that, it was always about GDP. Growth was the overriding objective, and any other problems was kind of like subjugated to these goals. So now we don't have that anymore. So all the other policy problems like regulation, like environment, like climate change, tax compliance, all these problems now have kind of resurfaced and are now kind of like much more prominent than they were in the past when GDP was the top goal. And I think what has happened is that the leadership around Xi Jinping realized that they need something that can replace GDP as a as an overarching goal for policymakers. So they needed something that gives policymakers at the local level some guidance. And I think common prosperity matches that criteria quite well for them, because they say, okay, yes, you need to focus on other things as well, but make sure that you reduce inequality. There have been several reports by Chinese economists have pointed out that the Gini coefficient in China is now 0.46 or 0.47. Even. That is one of the highest even among OECD countries. Within the OECD ranking, only Costa Rica has a worse Gini coefficient, like not even the US, not the UK, but only Costa Rica is worse than China. And I think that is quite a strong warning signal. And having common prosperity as a goal and target for policymakers, I think is sort of the answer for Chinese leadership to kind of address this problem.
And so we now know where it's coming from a political sense, but this is the China Business Brief after all. How are businesses responding? Of course, in August, there were news stories that companies such as, I believe it was Ele.me or Meituan, whose CEO gave a press conference where he said that common prosperity was in the DNA of his company, and companies have been trying hard to incorporate this new language into their messaging in China. But what are some of the concrete ways you've seen this idea affecting the way that companies operate in the market?
So I think the two major changes that we've seen is that first, companies were criticized for actually not paying the workers enough. So I think that is something where we will see a much greater focus also by authorities, that especially like gig workers, zero-hour contract workers, they will be properly paid, that there will be social insurance contributions for these workers. The other change is that big Chinese companies are encouraged to increase their corporate social responsibility programs so that they spend more on charity. One point I want to make here is that this is first and foremost a policy that targets big Chinese tech companies, and those companies have so far kind of skirted the rules and have kind of avoided scrutiny from Chinese authorities, because it just generated growth, right? So, but now without this target, like local authorities just kind of said, oh, wait a minute, actually, you also should follow the rules. For some companies like Didi and Ele.me and these huge kind of platform businesses, that's a huge problem. As for foreign business, I would say most of foreign businesses, at least the big ones in China, are actually very compliant with. So they do everything by the book. And if they don't know anything, then they ask Chinese authorities how to do it. So for Chinese authorities, I think the big headaches are these domestic Chinese tech firms.
And so we begin to see it being rolled out amongst business. But of course, as you mentioned earlier in the show, it has a societal function and it's geared towards adapting changing society in a way that's going to replace society's previous focus on these GDP targets. But that requires a big legislative change that's probably going to need a new tax system, you know, introducing a new, as you describe it, central right welfare state model. That's going to require a lot of policies being overhauled. How is that going to work? And do you think that the government has it within its powers to actually introduce the reforms and changes that it needs to make a success of common prosperity?
Yes, well, that's the 1 billion yuan question in a sense, that whether the current approach can really work. So far with what we've seen with the Zhejiang Common Prosperity Plan is that China kind of still tries to use a decentralized model. One model that has really worked well with like the special economic zones and with the generation of GDP and economic growth. But nowadays is a question whether the same decentralized model will work for the creation of prosperity or for a national welfare state. So we've already seen that with the pension system, that there's a huge discrepancy between some provinces who have like an comparatively older population versus those who were like in the south, who are kind of like economic powerhouses and generate a lot of pension contributions. For the pension system, there's already a transfer mechanism in place. But we don't have that for health insurance. We don't have it for education. We don't have it for any type of unemployment insurance system. And that is the big question. So how can it work? So the first big push I think we're going to see is increased tax compliance. So income tax is still a comparatively little factor within the Chinese budget. So we're at around like 2% of overall budget. So the OECD average is around like 8%. So the first step would be kind of to increase that. But then there's the problem that a lot of these social welfare spending is done at the local level. So if you're living in a rich kind of Chinese municipality like Shanghai or Beijing, I mean, you're kind of fine because the local governments really have the financial means to cover all that. But if you're like somewhere in Western China or like in a region where you have a huge population outflow, then you face a certain problem because you don't generate the revenue to actually cover all these social costs. So that is probably the biggest challenge in the coming years. And there are some doubts that that can work. And I think even for a Chinese leader like Xi Jinping, this is a huge headache. So how to approach this problem, how to create a working transfer mechanism where you can transfer money from the richer provinces to the poorer provinces?
Well, it's obviously so much more complicated than what a lot of the analysis out there has suggested. This is not a return to the days of Mao, and it's unlikely to mean the end of luxury brands in China. That's a question that I've been asked a few times, particularly given the UK's expertise and brand recognition in luxury goods. We'll have to keep an eye on it, and we'd love to hear your views on common prosperity. If you're listening, do reach out to either Torsten or myself. Torsten, thanks for coming on the podcast. This has been a great opener to season 2 of the China Business Brief.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with another episode in 2 weeks' time. Thank you. Goodbye. The China Business Brief is a podcast brought to you by the China Britain Business Council. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you're subscribed. To find out more about our other events and activities, do check out our website at www.cbbc.org.